Good morning and welcome to Spotlight on Industry. I'm your host, Sam Mason. This month, we begin a three-part series on small business. We'll kick off the series by spending some time with Dr. Ben Blackford from the Melvin and Valerie Booth College of Business and Professional Studies at Northwest Missouri State University. Dr. Blackford is an expert on entrepreneurship and will share some thoughts on the importance of small businesses and the impact they have on local economies. The first company we'll shine our spotlight on is the J.L. Houston Company in Hopkins, Missouri. Although no longer considered a small company, the J.L. Houston Company certainly started out that way when current CEO Ron Houston's father started it in 1954. We'll sit down with Ron to learn more about the company and tour the facility. In December and January, we'll visit other small businesses within the region to hear their stories. So stick around as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development. Coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at MaryvilleMo.org. And from Mazingo Lake Recreation Park. The park provides Nottoway County residents and visitors with an 18-hole golf course, driving range, and a 9-hole junior course coming 2015. More on Mazingo's golf offerings is at MazingoLake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, healthcare, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org. Support for KAXCV KRNW comes from SSM Health Medical Group, offering patients 10 locations and access to 46 primary care providers and specialists associated with St. Francis Hospital in Maryville. More information is available at ssmhealthstfrancis.com/locations.
Once again, good morning and welcome to Spotlight on Industry. If you're just joining us, this morning's program is part one of a three-part series we're doing on the importance of small businesses. We often hear that small businesses are the engines of job creation in the United States. Their value and the role they play in our economy is sometimes underestimated because they are, in fact, small. But the truth is, there's nothing small about the impact they have on the economy. According to a 2012 article by Brad Sugars in Entrepreneur Magazine, there are between 25 and 27 million small businesses in the United States. Although many of these businesses are considered micro companies because they only employ the owner, the statistics are pretty consistent in showing that 55 to 60% of all U.S. jobs are created by small business. Before we get into our interview with Ron Houston, I thought it would be good to learn more about the business of small business, so I sat down with Dr. Ben Blackford from the Booth College of Business and Professional Studies here at Northwest Missouri State University. Good morning, Dr. Blackford. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, normally on this show, we focus on industry and manufacturing, which we'll do in a few minutes when I visit with Ron Houston of the J.L. Houston Company. But first, I wanted to focus on small business. Now, of course, the J.L. Houston Company and Houston Polytank are not small businesses, but they certainly started out that way. Now, before we get into our discussion, let's tell our audience just a little bit about your credentials and your experience.
Well, my PhD is from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and I'm proud to say that my undergraduate degree and my MBA both were from Northwest. In between those, I was co-owner of a small consulting company actually here in Maryville, and we did small business consulting and management consulting along with financial consulting. And then one of our big things actually ended up being web development, which is a great example of how small businesses have to change based upon what the market wants, because that wasn't really something we had planned on doing initially. And beyond that, I also have about 20 years of retail management experience.
So open this up with just a very broad topic about small business and the important role that it plays on local economies.
Well, small business is huge for the local economy. As you mentioned, you know, all businesses, they start small. And so even, you know, the very large ones we see now, Walmart, Google, all of them started as a small business. So from that standpoint, they're a huge impact on the economy. And we also see a large number of new jobs that are created by small businesses and provide actually the majority of the employment in the U.S. is from a small business. It's just 10, 15, 20 people at a time, whereas when you see big employers like Walmart employing 1 or 2 million people, yeah, that's a huge impact on the economy, but when you have enough small businesses, they make up for that.
What percentage of jobs in the U.S. would you say are created by small business?
Well, in general, depends on when the stats are taken and how the stats are taken, but most ones I've seen are between 55 and 60%. And when we look at those, the reason I say it depends is that it comes down to how they collect the data. Some surveys like that will go by how many people work at a location, and they'll say everything, every location under 500 people is a small business. Well, that may be your local franchise. That may even be your local Walmart or Hy-Vee, which while they're, you know, a great force for the economy locally because of the jobs they provide, we wouldn't really consider them to be a small business. But they occasionally, in some of these surveys, they get counted as one because the location has less than 500 or less than 250 people. But overall, we see that, and I even tell students that chances are you're going to end up working for a small business. Just statistically speaking, you've got more than a 50% chance that that's who you're going to work for.
And when we look at an economy like Maryville, Northwest Missouri, to your point, the local franchise is a small business, but it's part of a much larger company.
And that's part of the interesting entrepreneurship and small business. The definition becomes so clouded because, you know, some people would say that entrepreneurship is starting your own independent business. Some people say entrepreneurship is starting a franchise. And it goes back to that numbers and how do you define a small business, and is it by location or by number of total employees? And so all of that kind of comes together to make that a really interesting conversation to have, because you can say small business to one person and they're going to have a completely different definition than someone else has. And same with entrepreneurship. People are, when you say entrepreneurship, you can put 100 people in a room and they won't have the same definition.
Now, sometimes when we talk about small businesses, we're really talking about micro businesses that are just one employee, correct?
In some cases, and that's actually, if you look at statistics, that's probably the most popular business, just because they're so easy to start, they're convenient, people can do them while they're working another job, and so they tend to really like those. And we see that a lot for service businesses especially, because they don't require a lot of capital to get started. Someone can start their own business, you know, just right out of their basement, out of their home, and it makes it really easy for them to start and generate some additional income for themselves. And sometimes we see those actually grow and become so successful, those do become their sole means of income, and then they start to employ additional people and help the economy there as well.
Now, the three businesses that we're focusing on for this three-part series on Spotlight focus on, one, the J.L. Houston Company, which I'll be talking with Ron a little later in the program. That started out with just his father, who was a metal culvert salesman who decided he could manufacture it himself, and that's grown into a company of 40-plus people. We're also going to be talking with the Wool Shop over in Grant City, which currently only has 10 employees, but that's grown from just Alan Andrews' mother making dusters in her basement, and that's a company that's had a long-standing history now of putting out that product. And then the last one that we're featuring is a beekeeper in Chillicothe, Missouri, who's found an interesting niche for his business. So all three different businesses in different phases of their life cycle. Now, a company like Houston started with one man and they now have 40 plus employees. Is that considered now a medium-sized company? Is it based on number of employees, based on revenues? Where does a business cross that threshold from small business to medium-sized?
And that's a great question, and that comes down to a couple of different factors. One is, as I mentioned, there's not always a great definition of small business to start with. So if we're not, you know, completely sure when a business is a small business, it's hard to know when it's no longer a small business. And a lot of that comes down to who you ask. So various, for example, governmental agencies, most of them consider a small business to be anyone under 500 employees. Some consider it to be under 250 employees. And then, for example, they have another term, a micro business, which you'd mentioned earlier, and that's any under 10 employees. So at some point, we would say that that's when they transition. And to kind of build on that point, another interesting twist is that we often think small businesses have to be new businesses. And as you mentioned, several of those businesses are very successful and been around for a very long time and have remained small, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're new. We also, on the other hand, we see businesses that will try to immediately launch with 200 or 300 people, and they're new, but we might not consider them small.
So what resources are available locally here in Northwest Missouri for a person who has maybe been displaced from a job that they're in? They say, you know what, I'm tired of corporate America. Let's move on. I'm going to work for myself. What resources are available for that person?
Well, we're actually in a great region for resources like that. There's so many resources available to help people out that are interested in that. We've got the Small Business and Technology Development Center. There's a center on our campus in the CIE, which is the Center of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, the Dean Hubbard Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And so that's available on the north side of the campus, and they offer some great resources for businesses in addition to also being an incubator. So new businesses that are just getting started and need a location so that they can operate but can't really afford a large space can, for very reasonable and reduced amounts, have an incubator space in the CIE, which helps them get started and gives them that place to work and kind of adds some legitimacy to their business, having that actual office. So that's a great source. And through them and the SBA, lots of resources available. We've also got in Northwest Missouri Enterprise Facilitation, which is a nonprofit group that offers free consulting and assistance to small businesses. So that's a great resource. We also have, from a state standpoint, for example, the Missouri State Small Business Site is often ranked top 5, top 10 in the country as one of the best state websites for helping small businesses. And it's a great site. It helps people step by step how they can get a small business started. And so those are just some of the great resources that we have available, as well as many successful entrepreneurs that are very willing to give their time and give their advice. It kind of becomes a club once they've successfully started a small business, and many of them just want to help other people be successful as well. And so that's another resource that I really encourage people not to overlook, just taking a successful entrepreneur out for coffee and asking them what they can learn from their experiences.
And there's so much information available online. It's great to have local resources like Northwest Enterprise Facilitation, like local entrepreneurs and successful businessmen, so that a person can really sit down and, I guess, pick their brain to find out what those first steps are to launching a new business.
Now, those can be a great resource, and they're all there to help. They are all, everyone I've ever met that's in that area, they're doing it because they just love small business, love entrepreneurship, and want to see people be successful and help grow the local economy.
What would you say, if you had to narrow it down to the single most important thing for an entrepreneur to take into consideration when they're thinking about starting up their own business?
Well, if I had to narrow it down to one thing before they started, because once they decide to start, there's a multitude of things that will help make them successful. But I think the one thing before they start is to just make sure they're ready to start. We see the movies, new Steve Jobs movie. It's makes all this money, and yeah, he's very intense, but people tend to equate that to starting their business and someday I'm going to be huge and have a $1 billion company. But it oftentimes those stories that we hear gloss over the 80, the 100-hour work weeks. There's a great quote that floats around that's almost become urban legend, that an entrepreneur is someone who's willing to work 80 to 100 hours a week for themselves so they don't have to work 40 hours a week for somebody else. And just lots of the stories tend to skip to the end. So probably the most important thing is that entrepreneur really ready to take the leap, and are they prepared for all that that's going to entail? And that's not to discourage entrepreneurs, because that's one of the great jobs in the world, is being able to do that and take that risk and start a job. and start a new small business or even a large new business. But that's the big thing is for them to do that kind of soul searching before they get started and be sure that they're ready for what this is going to entail.
Oftentimes, the market thinks they want something. And when they get that something, they don't necessarily patronize it. Explain that.
Yeah, that does become a concern for potential entrepreneurs and small business owners in small towns, big cities, that they'll go to their friends and family and say, I'm thinking about starting this business, or they'll listen to people around the community and people will say, we want this, we want this, why don't we have this? We really think a business like this would go well in Maryville or in North Kansas City, even for that matter. And what I caution the entrepreneur on is asking yourself, you've talked to these 25 or 30 people that say, this is a great business idea, you should hurry up and start it. And my question then would be, will your business be successful if those 25 or 30 people are the only ones that actually come and patronize your business? And my advice to them would be, do some additional research. You may make the best cookies or cupcakes in the world, and everyone will tell you after they've tried your cookies and cupcakes, you should really start a business. But are there enough other people that will come buy them from you in order for that to be a sustainable business? So that becomes a big question for a potential small business owner or entrepreneur is, you know, that unofficial market research is great and can maybe help you generate and develop the idea. But I really recommend they go to like an SBTDC or contact the SBA, or there's lots of free resources. The U.S. Census has a great website also for looking at those types of things, how many people are in your target market, for example, and doing that additional research to make sure once you go through all the work and dedicate all the time and resources to starting that business, that there will be a sufficient market there to help that business thrive and grow.
Now, I've heard that one of the best ways to completely ruin your hobby is to turn it into a business. I would think that one of the pitfalls a small business owner might fall into is burnout. I mean, let's say that you make great cupcakes and you open your doors and you get an order for 100 cupcakes. Does that person really want to make 100 cupcakes every day for the rest of their life? So I would think that sustainability would be an important thing to consider when opening a new business. Is this something that I enjoy doing enough to do it for the rest of my life?
Yeah, that becomes a great consideration because, you know, I know of examples where people have started a small business because it was their hobby. And yeah, as you mentioned, it's a lot of fun when they can do it whenever they want to and when people aren't paying them for it, because, you know, if you're giving it away, people aren't too worried about how soon they get it. But once it becomes they're paying for it, that can add extra layer of complexity that sometimes a person's not ready for when they transition from doing it as a hobby to doing it as their business. And that's how many businesses get started, because as mentioned earlier, they tend to already have everything they need in order to, you know, produce whatever that is that they're doing or whatever service they're providing as a hobby. They've got everything available to do it because they're already doing it. So it makes starting the business really easy. But it does come down to, you know, we always tell people, you know, you should do what you enjoy and you'll never work a day in your life. But we also want to make sure that it doesn't hinder your enjoyment. It needs to be something that you'll still enjoy once there's that slightly different dynamic of now you're getting paid for it.
Well, Dr. Blackford, I certainly appreciate you coming in today. Do you have any final thoughts on starting up new business here in Northwest Missouri?
Well, thank you for having me. And really my final thoughts would be just to encourage those that are prepared and know what they're getting themselves into to take that leap and do it. It's a great rewarding career for them, helps the local economy, and is really kind of a way to help everybody around you while also helping yourself and doing something that they'll enjoy.
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
That's Dr. Ben Blackford from the Booth College of Business and Professional Studies at Northwest Missouri State University. talking about small business in Northwest Missouri and the important role it plays in our economy. He also mentioned that this is a great region to start up a business due to such resources as Northwest Missouri Enterprise Facilitation and Northwest Missouri State University's Dean L. Hubbard Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. More information about these organizations is available at nwmef.org or nwmissouri.edu/CIE. The first company we're featuring in this three-part series is the J.L. Houston Company in Hopkins, Missouri. Hopkins is a small town of about 530 residents and is located 15 miles north of Maryville. Like many towns in the Midwest, Hopkins once had a prosperous downtown, but a tornado in 1952 greatly damaged the business district, and the departure of the railroad in 1983 has left the town without much commerce, save for a grain elevator, the J.L. Houston Company, and its sister company, Houston Polytank. The two companies are operated by CEO Ron Houston, whose father started the business as a metal culvert manufacturer in 1954. The company now manufactures both steel and plastic tanks that are used for storage in a multitude of industries, such as agriculture, chemical, petroleum, food, mining, pharmaceuticals, and water treatment. As we learned from Dr. Blackford, it's hard to define what is and what isn't a small business. The J.L. Houston Company definitely started its life as a small enterprise with just one man who believed that he could make a little money by manufacturing a product himself rather than selling someone else's. Since its birth, the company has grown to more than 40 employees, their product line has expanded, and their manufacturing techniques have improved. It's a great example of how one man's idea and spirit still lives on 61 years later. I sat down with Ron Houston and General Manager Kobe Hayes to learn more. Gentlemen, good morning and welcome to Spotlight on Industry.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Ron, I think it's safe to say that many people who listen regularly to KXCV or are frequent visitors to the Northwest Missouri State Campus are at the very least familiar with your name. But for those who aren't, let's start by telling us a little bit about the J.L. Houston Company.
Well, we manufacture steel storage tanks primarily. We originally were manufacturing a culvert pipe that my dad started doing in 1954. But as time has gone on, we don't build the culvert pipe, but we do build a lot of different steel tanks. And now even plastic tanks.
You said your father started the company in 1954. He started manufacturing the steel culvert. What was it that inspired him to start his own business?
He had been in business for quite a few years prior to that, selling culvert pipe, and he sold chain from Lloyd Chain and plumbing supplies and things of that nature. So it used to be when we had a railroad in this town, why could bring in culvert pipe on rail cars and he would sell it directly. And apparently he decided that there was a chance to profit a bit by making it ourselves. So he built our first little building over here and bought the equipment and became in the culvert business.
And when did he transfer that over to the steel tanks?
Well, I think we started building steel tanks about the time that I came back from college here. And I went to Northwest for 3 years, and then I transferred to University of Missouri, and I graduated from there with a degree in engineering. So he was thinking of getting into the steel tank business and had bought some of the equipment, but then when I came back, we went ahead and built more buildings here, and still the culvert business was the predominant business. But as time went along, the tank business grew, and the culvert business became more and more competitive, and so it diminished somewhat. So I'm not sure what year it was when we got rid of the culvert part, but we built both of them together for a lot of years. I think probably 25 or so years ago, we sold the equipment that we had that was related to the culvert business, and the space in the buildings, why we now use that for tank fabrication.
And Kobe, how long have you been with the company?
23 years.
And as general manager, I presume that your role is to really just oversee all the operations?
Yes, that's true. I do get, we all get involved in sales at a smaller office like ours to a certain degree, but I spend a lot of time over in the plant also and do a lot of plant management, I guess you'd say, too. Oh, production, QC, those kind of things.
So, Ron, when you finished up at the University of Missouri with your engineering degree, did you come straight back to Hopkins and go to work for your dad, or did you also have a stop along the way?
Well, I had a short stop. I was in Kansas City for a little over a year. I worked at the Bendix plant, which ran the Atomic Energy Commission operation there. And so after I'd been there for a year or so, my dad convinced me, I guess, that I should come back here. So here I am.
And here you are. And so let's go back and let's talk just a little bit more about, starting with the steel tanks and their application, and where do those go once they leave the facility here in Hopkins?
I'd say predominantly in the Midwest, kind of a five-state region, you know, with Illinois being part of that. We do go all over. We go to Texas quite a bit, and we don't go to the West Coast as much as we used to. Go out east some, and we ship the product ourselves. We have our own trucks and drivers that makes it pretty convenient. We can be a little more competitive that way.
And the tanks are used for what?
Mostly chemicals and petroleum, mostly petroleum products. But we do some chemical storage and some food grade stuff. Not too much of that, but some.
And there's some storage for airplane fuel, is that correct? Is that what I'm kind of seeing out on your,
we do the side of the
building?
We also build some ag products, fertilizers, you know, some good size large storage tanks for fertilizer, but we do build tanks for the jet fuel industry. That's what gets us involved in shipping quite a ways away sometimes. That's kind of a niche we have, not everybody does.
And the tanks we've been talking about so far are the steel tanks, but yet there's a whole other product line which are the poly tanks. So tell me a little bit about those.
Well, that's a company that we partnered with a technology coming from Germany and Israel about around 5 years ago. And so we built another building here for it, which we are now expanding. It's under construction. And we are still having growing pains and trying to get our product line completed, it's a growing business, but it's not growing fast enough.
And is there an advantage to the poly tank over the steel tank? Do they have similar applications, or are they completely separate?
They're mostly pretty separate. The poly tanks are aimed towards a corrosive storage, like acids, bleaches, things of that nature, wastewater, things that would corrode a steel tank, and they're better stored in a plastic tank. And the tanks that we build are a real heavy wall tank. They're not like a rotationally molded tank that's pretty thin. These tanks are heavy duty.
Is there a limitation of the size for the steel tanks versus that of the poly tanks? I've seen some of the poly tanks, and they're pretty good. They're pretty large.
They are, but we build bigger steel tanks than we do poly tanks. And I think we build sometimes up to 50,000 gallons, I believe. We've done quite a few 40,000.
In poly, you mean?
In steel.
Yeah, the biggest in poly is 40,000, and we've built the biggest in steel is 50,000.
Okay.
We actually could build a little bigger, but you're limited on what you can haul. So we have to kind of maxed out at about 50,000.
If you're building a 50,000-gallon tank, can you build the entire tank here on site and ship it, or do you ship it in pieces and assemble it on site?
We build everything here. We're a shop fabrication company. We don't do field erect. We actually have one job now in poly, though, which is we're going to build the tanks and then cut them up and transfer them to a site in St. Louis and then reconnect them, put them back together because of the problem getting into the building.
Oh, I see.
But typically, no, everything's built complete here.
Okay. And so let's talk just a little bit about your employee base. How many employees do you have here?
I think we're right around the 45 range right now, well, with both companies.
And are those folks people who come in from primarily the Hopkins Pickering area, this section of Nottoway County, or do they come from up in Iowa and other places as well?
They do come some from Iowa. We do have quite a few local, I guess you'd say, in the Hopkins Pickering. I don't know if a few from Maryville, not too many, but up into the Bedford, Iowa and Taylor County area, we have several also.
I find that most of the companies that I feature on the program have employees who have long tenure with the companies, 25, 30, sometimes 40 years isn't uncommon. I'm sure you probably enjoy that same longevity here as well.
We do. We have several that have been here 20 plus years and some 30 plus years. And our foreman, who's will shortly be here 44 years, is now working half days, and we're kind of transferring to another gentleman for that. But yeah, we have quite a few longstanding employees.
But it's always nice to have that continuity where you don't have downtime due to training, really.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. In a few minutes, we're going to tour your facility, but before we do, what's the primary thing that you would like for our listeners to know about J.L. Houston Company?
I guess that we build steel storage tanks, and we'd like for them to own some of our products. We also stock and distribute a big range of petroleum equipment handling, like pumps and motors and meters and hoses and all of the things that a farm might like to use or might need to use.
Well, we'll get ready to take our tour, so I appreciate your time. Thanks for sitting down with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You bet.
That's Ron Houston and Kobe Hayes from the J.L. Houston Company in Hopkins, Missouri. As we've heard, the role that small business plays in any economy is important. Small companies provide jobs. The people who hold those jobs spend their paychecks to pay bills, and, hopefully, the discretionary dollars are spent locally. If the business is located in a large metropolitan area, merchants will garner some of their sales from locals, but much of it comes from outside the community. When a small business is located in a town as small as Hopkins, it becomes vitally important. Ron has 45 people from the area who depend on the company for their livelihood. Although there isn't much retail commerce in the town of Hopkins for those people to spend their dollars on, the city relies heavily on a company like J.L. Houston. Wages that are paid to employees who live in Hopkins and surrounding small towns will come back to the city in the form of real estate and personal property taxes. Some of those tax dollars will benefit the local school, fix roads, and pay for law enforcement. Of course, the company itself pays its own taxes, and the community relies heavily on that money for support. In fact, with so few residents, one shudders at the thought of what might happen to a town like Hopkins if the company weren't there. When J.L. Houston started his company in 1954, he just wanted to sell more culvert pipe than the next guy. Hopkins had survived a tornado, but things were coming together. At least they still had the railroad. Little did he know that less than 30 years later, the railroad would be gone and much of the retail would soon follow. So you can see that without a company like Houston, the town may very well have ceased to exist. Small business is what drives the economy, especially in small towns like Hopkins. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go on a tour of the plant to see how they fabricate both steel and poly storage tanks. Stick around.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at MarylandMO.org. And from Mazinga Lake Recreation Park, the park offers residents and visitors camping facilities for tents and RVs, as well as lakeside cabin rentals. Mazinga Lake also offers boating, fishing, hiking, and equestrian trails. More information about Mazingo is at MazingoLake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, healthcare, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org. Support for KAXCV KRNW comes from SSM Health Medical Group, offering patients 10 locations and access to 46 primary care providers and specialists associated with St. Francis Hospital in Maryville. More information is available at ssmhealthstfrancis.com/locations.
Welcome back to Spotlight on Industry. If you're just joining us, this is part one of a three-part series we're doing on small businesses and the impact they have on local economies. The first company we're spotlighting is the J.L. Houston Company and Houston Polytank in Hopkins, Missouri. The two companies build steel and plastic storage tanks that range in size from 100 gallons to 50,000 gallons. The larger tanks are up to 14 feet in diameter and 44 feet tall. Some of the tanks lay down horizontally, while others are designed to stand upright. Some of them are double-walled to prevent the contents from leaking. Others are insulated to protect the contents from extreme temperatures, and some are even fire-resistant. Most of the tanks are cylindrical, but some are rectangular. Some stand on stilts. Some lay on half-moon-shaped saddles. Others are enclosed by walls. Most of them are designed for above-ground applications, but others are designed for underground use. As you can now imagine, Houston's tanks come in all shapes and sizes. These are serious pieces of equipment, and their customers rely on them to be 100% leak-free. They're designed to contain everything from petroleum and jet fuels to food products. This is another example of how a product that is made right here in Northwest Missouri touches the lives of everyday people. Almost every manufacturer in the U.S. has need to store raw materials prior to or after the production process. Chances are, the fuel in your car or the food on your plate was once stored in a J.L. Houston tank. The products I've just described to you are all steel storage tanks. J.L. Houston's sister company, Houston Polytank, makes similar-sized tanks out of polypropylene or polyethylene, both of which are plastic materials. As we set off on our tour of their fabrication shops, we started in the Polytank building and spoke to the facility's manager, Ron Elkana. There are three main components used to make a polytank. There's the mold, the raw materials, and the extruder. The molds are enormous steel cylinders, some of which are up to 17 feet in diameter, and they lay horizontally on rollers. The raw materials are small, white plastic beads that are about the size of BBs for an air rifle. They pipe these beads and pigmented beads into a hopper that mix the two together. The hopper feeds the beads into an extruder that uses heat to melt them into a homogeneous molten liquid. This molten material is extruded through a die and wrapped around the mold. Ron explains the process.
The extruder has heating element, five heating element, and it's a screw extruder, exactly like how you grind meat. Everything is heated, the plastic is heated, it's getting molten at temperature of about close to 450 degrees. And they're going through the extruder with very high pressure. They're getting here to a die. This is a die. From in this die, this is where the plastic, molten plastic, come out. The temperature here is also about 450 degrees Fahrenheit. And through this roller system, we take a bend of about half an inch by thick, a molten plastic, and with a width of about 8 inches, that which goes down through the roller to the rotating metal mold. And while we're doing that, we're moving the whole extruder on those rails.
Okay.
And we're getting a spiral winding. Every layer, like you put a bandage on your hand, every layer will cover the other by about an inch layup. And while we're doing that, we get a cylinder, continuous cylinder, that is half an inch thick. If we want it to be thicker, we add another layer. So each layer that we're doing add about, let's say, quarter of an inch at a time, and we don't have limit of how thick we can do other plastic.
As the molten plastic is wrapped around the mold, it becomes a cylinder. Once it cools overnight, the next step is to remove it from the mold. The molds are constructed of 5/8 inch steel with an internal structure that is also made of steel. As the plastic cools, it contracts and would crush the molds like an aluminum can if they weren't built to such heavy-duty standards. Each mold contains a hydraulically controlled panel that opens toward the inside, leaving a large gap in the wall of the mold. When the panel is opened, the mold can collapse a bit, thereby allowing the cylinder to slide off. Next, it's cut to length per the customer's specifications and fitted with a top and a bottom. Ron explains how they make those components.
Within our process, we also can do flat sheets. And we build the largest flat sheets in the country. And we use them for our bases and for our top. How we do that? While the plastic is still warm on the mold, we're not letting it cool down. We're taking it off, we're cutting it to the horizontally of the cylinder, pushing it out, and put weight on it for it to be flat. And we use it as a pieces, flat pieces for our bases and tops, and then we can use one piece for even a 14-foot diameter tank. We can use one piece that is not welded together.
After the tank is fitted with its top and bottom, various holes are drilled or cut out so that they can be further fitted with access panels, pipes, drains, etc. The tanks are extremely durable and will not bulge in or out as they are being filled and emptied. If they did, they'd be prone to developing stress fractures, which would ultimately lead to failures. The process was really quite fascinating to watch. We learned that Houston Polytank is the only company in the United States that builds plastic tanks of this size using this method. We wrapped up our tour with Ron Elkana and moved on to the next series of buildings where they build steel tanks. Our guides for that facility were Ron Houston and Kobe Hayes.
As far as a start to finish product, we have different starts, different finishes. We, up front here, we build some smaller tanks. We have our metals kind of strung from the first to the plant, to the middle of the plant, for different sizes that we get cut the length for different, you know, cookie cutter size of tanks that we have. Up front we have some parts work done. This is our press brake. That we have all our bending applications, our shear, it's a half inch plate shear. Any cutting that needs to be, we either cut it in that or with a lot of several hand plasma cutters we have. We build up front, we build a lot of, like I said, smaller applications. It would be like containment dikes or small pickup auxiliary tanks, like for farm use, for ag use. If we go on down, we have what we call our small tank line. Anything up to about 2,000 gallons gets built there. And that's what we were telling. We ship a lot of those on truckloads to distributors that go, and then they sell them one and two at a time to the customers. And so, as you're seeing here, it's not a typical application we do, but we do some custom bending and cutting work for local trucks and ag.
And so he's getting ready to put a bend in this piece of metal here?
Yeah, we have a CNC plasma table that we put bigger pieces on, and that's what he does. He cuts parts and bends them. Like I said, kind of custom bending and custom work is what he's doing here now. And not everybody can do that, so they come to us. That's not tank work, but it's still work.
Sure.
Still work for us.
And that looks like a piece of equipment that's been around for a little while.
That is a 300-ton brake. And there is actually more in the ground than there is above the ground.
Is that right?
Yeah, it really is. So it's very rare there's something that we can't bend.
As I mentioned earlier, Houston builds small tanks that hold 2,000 gallons of material, all the way up to tanks that hold 50,000 gallons. The smaller tanks are fabricated in the main plant building we were touring. It all starts with flat, plate steel that is cut to size, rolled into a cylinder, and then welded. Kobe walked us through the process.
I guess the middle section of our main building, our main plant we call it, we've come across some stock steel that we have. We also make our own heads or ends. Some places buy them, we make them. You know, have a little more control over that, and it helps cost-wise. We keep stock sizes, you know, for our standard tanks that we build. on all the smaller tanks. As we go on down, we get into some, it gets bigger as you go. We have four plate rolls, which roll our steel into a production ring. This is our biggest plate roll. Then we have a small one here that can build some smaller tanks on our small tank line, and then two more in the other buildings that serve the same purpose. But you can see what he's doing here. He's rolled steel into a ring. He's putting one of the heads on. He put the second head on. He'll tack it all in place, and we'll go down here in our we call it a hot roll, where there's a guy that just welds solid. When he completes that, it goes on down to one or two gentlemen who are tested. They put the fittings and the openings in, test it for leaks, repair if needed, then it goes to the paint shop.
As we walked along, we paused to watch an employee fit a top onto a tank. The steel stock is cut to the appropriate diameter, then taken to a brake that bends a lip around the edge. The worker then compresses the cylinder tank and fits the lid.
This way we make our heads or our ends. Like I said, we have a lot of standard stock sizes on the smaller ones. As they get a little bigger, this is an 8-foot diameter tank here, and it's fairly stock size too. As we get a little bigger than that, we make a few on stock, but they get a little different, so we have to make them as we need them. We get a couple pieces of metal, weld them together, and then we shear them in what we call our circle shear. It cuts the ends off with the least waste as possible, of course. Then we put the lip or the flange on them, and they're ready for production.
So it looks like he's collapsed that so that he can get the top on. He's rolled the top onto the top of it, and now if he releases that weld, the tank will expand and fill up the lid?
Inside the head, that's exactly right. He uses what we call like an air ram, which is what he'll do here now. Then it'll kind of, I guess, expand or pop inside that head. He'll do it on both sides that way. We've used that method for a lot of years, and it's worked for a lot of years. And he'll repeat the process on the other side, and in our busy season, which is about late January to about 1st September, really, we'll ship about 3 truckloads a week out of here.
Oh.
Out of this line right here.
Okay.
Tacking it solid, but move away when he does this side. Then he'll get all tacked completely solid, then we'll weld it up. The kind of thing we see done every day, so you don't think much about it.
Yeah.
But
after the tanks are tack welded and the lids are fitted, they go into a hot roll bay for the final welds. The tank sits horizontally on rollers and spins slowly while the worker makes the final weld.
This is what we call a hot roll. That's just the terminology we use, that we have kind of upgraded this to where a tank rolls underneath him. He doesn't move, he just welds the tank, which is rolling underneath him, and one continuous weld. Then when he's done, then it moves to the next station. The next person who will then weld fittings inside, openings, and then we'll weld and test it for leaks, and then complete the tank.
J.L. Houston's plant consists of many buildings, some of which include the original building his father started with. The larger tanks are built in other parts of the plant. The newest building on the steel tank side has a tower that must be close to 90 feet tall. I ask Ron to talk about their expansions.
How long has this building been up?
This building we built about 15 years ago, and then we've added on to it probably 5 years ago. Then this building, we've only been in it for about 2 years now. And it's definitely the biggest building. We have
about 75 feet under the hook in here. So yeah, it's a busy plant both here and across the street in the poly side.
Ron and Kobe, looks like we've come full circle through the plant, so I do appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. True to the spirit of small business, the J.L. Houston Company continues to grow. Presently, they are adding on to the poly tank plant, and the steel tank side has new equipment ready to be installed. If you'd like to learn more about the companies, visit their websites at jlhouston.com or houstonpolytank.com. I'd like to thank my guests this month, Ron Houston, Kobe Hayes, and Ron Elkana of the J.L. Houston Company in Hopkins, Missouri. I'd also like to thank Dr. Ben Blackford of the Booth College of Business and Professional Studies at Northwest Missouri State University. Join us next month as we continue our series on small business. We'll travel to the town of Grant City, Missouri, and visit with Alan Andrews of the Wool Shop. We'll hear about how Andrew's mother used wool from sheep that he raised for an FFA project to start a business out of her basement making lamb's wool dusters. Alan is not only the president of the company, he's also a state representative for the 1st District of the state of Missouri. As a legislator and small businessman, he has a vested interest in seeing new businesses come to Northwest Missouri. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next month as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, Mazingo Lake Recreation Park, and the City of Maryville. More information on all of our sponsors is available at MarylandMO.org. Spotlight on Industry is a production of KXCV-KRNW and Northwest Missouri State University. Our editor and producer is Karen Lawrence. For more information about how your company can be featured on Spotlight on Industry, please contact Sam Mason at 660-562-1163.